The important thing down there was to make it clear that if anything was to be done to better relations with Cuba, there's a lot he had to do, and indeed very little we have to do. And among the things that he has to do, and because we have a deep and burning interest which will persist, is humanity to the political prisoners. We saw political prisoners. I'm not going to give you the nonsense about the fact that, you know, they looked well fed and all that childishness. Of course, they wouldn't show us anybody else. But it was the terms that were so devastatingly tragic that not one of them had served less than 12 years, and the terms were 30. So I made that crystal clear. Secondly, that the reuniting of families was critical. This is quite apart from American prisons, which goes without saying that we would demand their release, all of them. And thirdly, that Cuba would never again be a platform to threaten the United States as it was in 62. And that it would never threaten the other American states as it has for the last 10 years. So I can assure you that the message was delivered right, straight, and clear, and unequivocal. And finally, the American states will meet at Quito, Ecuador on November 8th, only a few days after election, so we couldn't wait. At that time, there is strong sentiment to readmit Cuba to the organization. I hope my country will not fall for that. Our country, I hope, will stand aside and not concur. But in order to do that effectively, we have to have a rational basis for it. I have given our country that rational basis. We have a reason, because there are things we want, and until they're delivered, we can be just as stubborn as Mr. Caskin. I wanted you to understand. Thank you all very much, unless there are any questions.
I have a question.
Please.
One of them you answered already. Why did you go to Cuba?
Good. Thank you.
You might have lost a lot of Cuban votes. Now, why is it that Senator Pell had the nerve to come out of Cuba and start insulting the Cuban criminals?
Well, madam, you'll have to tell me what it was. I really can't.
Well, I can't.
I have no idea.
I don't know exactly what our paper had. A group of people who went there, and they are very angry because Senator Pell had a very insulting remarks about the Cuban women being loose women. And
well,
I was surprised because I always read Buckley's column, and he's supposed to be an aristocrat and a gentleman from Philadelphia. Well, in that respect, he did not behave like a gentleman, don't you think?
I would thoroughly agree with that, and I have nothing to say about it except that it's most deplorable, but I'll go further than that. I will dig up the quote. I don't know what it is because I was unaware of it, and I will write Senator Pell and ask him to explain the seeming slur and see that Diario gets the exchange of correspondence.
Diario La Prensa.
And La Prensa. Okay. I'll do it for
you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for being with us today. In announcing that organizations representing virtually all the police and firefighters in the state have endorsed my candidacy for re-election, and represented here, all of whom will say a word or two, are the uniformed firefighters of Greater New York, with Joe Donnelly, their vice president, the Uniformed Fire Officers Association, with Bill Hunter, the president, and Bill McCann, vice president, the Police Conference of New York, with Al Scaglione, the president, and then Johnny May of the New York City Transit Patrolmen's Benevolent Association. PBA couldn't make it. McFeely is on his way, but they endorse me, as well as the New York State Uniformed Firefighters, the Metropolitan Police Conference, the New York City Housing Authority Patrolmen's Benefit Association, and the New York State Parole Officers Association. Now, the reason for these endorsements is strictly on a labor basis. These are trade unions, and it is very gratifying to me to have the endorsement and support of particularly these trade unions, whose members, men and women alike, throughout the state, risk their lives daily to give us frontline protection against crime, fire, and other public safety threats. Throughout my public career, I've been an ardent advocate and defender of individual rights as guaranteed in the Constitution, known as civil rights. Yet at the same time, I've always recognized and will always continue to recognize that law enforcement and public safety are absolutely essential if we are to have a society worth living in, and that the greatest protection of the citizen is cooperation with the law enforcement and safety forces, and that they can do... They can do their work so much the more effectively if they do get the support of the rank and file of our citizen, of our citizens. That's why I've strongly supported and will continue to support legislation further to professionalize and assist police, firefighters, and related organizations, and to develop significant community participation in public safety activities. And I might just add to that, that I have always supported legislation.
They start being more concerned.
I think all women are concerned. They all want to be beautiful.
Maybe him can make me cool.
Voters in New York will be choosing a senator this year. And the choice, it seems to us, is between an effective pragmatist, Senator Jacob Javits, and an untried idealist, former Attorney General Ramsey Clark. Senator Javits has made an impressive record in his three terms in the Senate because he's mastered the fine art of legislative compromise. He's been able to quarterback such bills as the Pension Reform Act, which provides comprehensive pension protection for millions of American workers. Senator Javits also shepherded the War Powers Bill over a presidential veto to reaffirm Congress's role in the war-making process. But we think Ramsey Clark is a formidable opponent. The former attorney general is a symbol of integrity in government and has run an exemplary campaign, accepting contributions of only $100 or less. While we would like to think that there's a place in public life for Ramsey Clark, we would not like it to be at the cost of losing the services of Jacob Javits in the Senate. Senator Javits has a powerful grasp of the tough issues facing this country today, particularly in the crucial areas of fiscal policy and international economics. And we're not alone in appreciating Senator Javits' intellectual capacities. An independent poll taken among legislative assistants on Capitol Hill last year found Senator Javits to be the most intelligent senator in Washington. What's more, New Yorkers have a big investment in Jacob Javits, for he's racked up more seniority than any senator from New York in recent history. Senator Javits is too good to lose. That's why WCBS-TV endorses him tonight. And that's the opinion of the management of WCBS-TV. I'm Sue Cott.
Okay. At this distance. Okay. You let me know. My voice is adequate for the purpose, friend. Okay, I'm ready. I consider the enactment of the federal law establishing national endowments in the arts and humanities, which now command appropriations in the area of $150 million a year, to be one of the most significant aspects of my career in public life and in terms of expectation for future development, because they have stimulated a demand for cultural development in areas of the country heretofore parched and dry, for example, of showings of sculpture and painting and live music and opera and theater, which are now being partially satisfied. And also the enactment of this law, which took 19 years to bring about, is a great instruction on how the Senate and the Congress of the United States work, because the law was passed as a great constituency was developed throughout the United States for federal aid to the arts, and that constituency dictated action by the Congress. It was joined in, in response to the constituency by distinguished members of the House, like Emanuel Seller of New York and Frank Thompson of New Jersey, and by distinguished members of the Senate, like Hubert Humphrey, late lamented, a very great American, by Claiborne Pell, of Senator from Rhode Island, and by Joe Clark, Senator from Pennsylvania. When I first introduced the bill, the first bill, in 1949 in the House to provide for a national theater and opera and ballet, it was laughed at as an idle gesture, which was no business of government, even though it followed the precedent of the British Arts Council established in 1946, later followed by the Canadian Arts Council established in 1956. And even though national arts programs were the rule in an overwhelming majority of the major nations of the world, the constituency in the United States to support this legislation was built up slowly, first gaining the support of people in the United States who were interested in the arts of painting and sculpture through amendments to the tariff laws, which permitted the free entry of such works of art which were made of unorthodox materials like paper. This amendment was first adopted in 1959. The goal was also aided enormously by state-assisted arts programs, which came in the late 50s with Governor Nelson Rockefeller of New York as a significant leader in the movement which he in effect began. We now have 50 such state arts councils which get some important federal government financing. The climax which brought about the final enactment of the National Arts and Humanities Endowments was the direct personal interest of Presidents Jack Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson that finally brought success in 1965. The future is very bright, because the main objection to these federal and state programs was that the arts would be exploited by politicians, would be politicized. But this experience has been shown to be invalid. On the contrary, the public demand for the best in the arts has grown enormously. Vast areas of the country have been opened up to the arts, and also the inadequacy of private philanthropic resources, importance as they are to satisfy the demand for the arts by the American people, has been clearly demonstrated, period. For the future, it is up to those who believe in these arts programs to support, maintain, and expand the momentum already developed. I have every confidence that the great public response will produce this effect and that we will see a goal of $300 million achieved within the next years for the federal program on the arts. We are all familiar with the worries of our older citizens about the financial viability of the Social Security system. I have no doubt that a good deal will be done about that within the next few years in the Congress. But what we need in this country, above all in this field, is a coordinated retirement policy, coordinating private pension and welfare plans with the Social Security system. The effective legislation now on the books, passed in 1974, of which I had the honor to be a co-author, is the Employees Retirement Income Security Act, known by the acronym ERISA. This law, in fact, guarantees the private pension rights of over 30 million workers through a government insurance corporation, which is supported with premiums paid by these pension plans, which are mainly employer, though in some cases employer-employee financed, and which have assets of over $500 billion. Now, the regulation is of private, not governmental, retirement plans. Governmental retirement plans are not regulated by the federal government as yet, but I have little doubt that they will be, as they too have weaknesses and injustices which need correction. The financial strain on the Social Security system and the lack of a national retirement income policy represent a joint problem for the future. I believe it will be met by an integration of private pension plans and the Social Security system. Indeed, that private pension plans may in time be made mandatory and not just the subject of worker-employer negotiation. Therefore, even the regulation of the private pension system needs reform, as today it is vested in a divided jurisdiction between the Treasury and the Labor Departments, period. In addition, we have not dealt with all the problems of the private pension system. First and foremost is the problem of the transfer of pension rights when an individual employee changes jobs. In addition, there are still some problems of the actuarial soundness of the insurance of private pensions through the pension benefit and guarantee corporation, which supplies the insurance to which I have referred. In passing ERISA, Congress acted in response to outrageous injustices disclosed by public hearings, which I conducted throughout the country with the other co-author, Senator Williams of New Jersey. These injustices were perpetrated under the unregulated private pension systems, which preceded 1974, by which great numbers of workers were exploited when the pension promise was not kept, or when, under the terms of the fine print of the pension contract, workers were fired or otherwise deprived of their pension rights after working 20, 25, or 30 years to earn their pensions. Here again, there is a vast and challenging field of enormous importance to the well-being of millions of workers in our country as the population curve, which is expected to produce about 20% of the population as being eligible for pensions sometime before the end of the century, and health improvement tend to create a larger group of older citizens. And as the dignity of retirement becomes a major sociological factor in American life, the Vietnam War is dismissed by many as ancient history today and has been succeeded by other issues of a burning character. But it still remains a national experience so dismaying that we must learn from it. Its beginning and its end is completely documented in my papers, now deposited with the State University at Stony Brook. It began with the adoption of the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution in 1964. When first passed, I supported that resolution and its underlying cause to preserve freedom in South Vietnam and to prevent its conquest by communist North Vietnam under the guise of a war of national liberation, a cause that appealed to me. But when at the end of 1966, I learned from British sources that reasonable terms of settlement were not acceptable to President Lyndon Johnson, but that he aspired to total defeat for North Vietnam, I broke with the support of the war. In February 1967, I called for a halt to the bombing of North Vietnam and a resolution of the conflict by new elections in both Vietnams with the participation of the National Liberation Front. The basic historic significance of my ensuing part in the struggle to terminate. Participation by U.S. armed forces in the Vietnam War was significant historically because it led me to the espousal of the War Powers Resolution, which was passed over President Nixon's veto in November of 1973. This War Powers Resolution, now the law of the land, restrains the president from using the powers given to him by the Constitution as commander-in-chief of all the armed forces of the United States to commit the nation to war, a situation which we faced over 100 times in the over 200 years of the establishment of this republic. And that power is restrained by the War Powers Resolution, which limits the president's power as commander-in-chief to commit our armed forces to hostilities to only 60 days, after which time the power ends unless the Congress acts affirmatively to concur in the use of the armed forces of the United States as committed by the President. The War Powers Resolution follows also the National Commitments Resolution authored by a great senator, Senator Clifford Case of New Jersey, which declares that no obligation of the United States committing its forces or resources to a foreign cause shall be binding unless affirmatively approved by the Congress. It is these two restraints on presidential war making as they develop in the future and their application now given to the Congress, which work an effective restraint on war and on which and which the United States has not had since the founding of the Republic. These resolutions seek to resolve the division of powers, which is a twilight zone created by the Constitution in giving the President the authority over our armed forces as commander-in-chief and the Congress the sole authority to declare war. By these resolutions, which do not contravene the Constitution because they are a methodology, not a grant of new authority, that the American people are now further protected as they have never been before against reckless unleashing of the dogs of war. And I use in this respect the words of the men who wrote the Constitution of the United States, period. But whether they will be effective to protect our people depends on the determination of the Congress in their implementation. And I hope and pray that the people will keep the feet of the Congress to the fire to see that these resolutions really have the effect intended by others like myself, their drafters. Now you see what The Senate having a special role under the Constitution in respect to foreign policy due to its power to ratify treaties by a two-thirds majority and to confirm the appointment of ambassadors. The opportunity is also presented to individual senators to utilize their positions respecting great international issues, which may not necessarily be the subject of legislation in the Congress or of treaty ratification by the Senate. I wish to emphasize that this is a very valuable aspect of a senator's work, as I'll show by a few examples culled from my own papers now at the State University at Stony Brook, period. This kind of activity will be, I hope, a developing aspect of the work of individual senators, marking an expansion of their ability and experience to deal with major foreign or even domestic policy problems and to enhance the maturity of their experience, which is so essential to the making of foreign and domestic policy in the United States. Let me give these examples. One, the period from 1972 to 1974 inclusive, including my work as chairman, or rather included my work as chairman, of the Committee of Nine of the Parliamentarians Conference of the NATO countries, some 230 representatives of those countries, which charted the strategic course of NATO for the future. The committee had an unusually distinguished membership, among them being Manlio Brosio, who had been Secretary General of NATO, Lord Harlech of the United Kingdom, formerly UK Ambassador to the United States, and Lester Pearson, former Prime Minister of Canada, and others from other countries, like Germany and France and others. The report of the Committee of Nine, issued in 1974, forecast